Hey, welcome to Divergent Paths with Dan Dunford. I'm the host, Dan Dunford, which is probably not necessary for me to say since my name is in the damn title. But I say it every week. It's great. Anyway, welcome to episode number 41. Last week was episode 40, and I didn't say anything about it on the intro, which is, you know, whoa, how could I just let that go by? But seriously, like, it was, you know, 40 is a big number. Like, that's a lot. I mean, of course, they just keep coming, so 50 will be another big number. I don't know where I'm going with this. Anyway, this week, I sat down with Josh Landris, who runs probably the main, like, the most, he runs a brass repair shop here in New York that pretty much all the brass players in the city use. I mean, he's the go-to guy if you need a brass repair done. It's a great shop in Midtown. He's done a lot of work for me. I've bought instruments and mouthpieces from him. Great dude. You know, he's been really good to me, and he was nice enough to sit down with me and just talk, and it was a lot of fun. We had a really fun time. It's actually a little bit funny story. At the beginning of the interview, I mentioned a couple times about it being a second try. Just the first time I went into tape with him, it was a before business hours. And unfortunately, the shop is in Midtown, which is super convenient for everyone, really. But it's right next to a parking lot where they're doing construction, and there was just loud jackhammering, and it just didn't stop. And tried for a half hour to try and get something done, and just didn't work. So I had to come back later. No jackhammers when you come in after business hours. So anyway, I was really appreciative of Josh sitting down with me, and he's just an interesting dude. He's got a lot to say, and he really, really just loves what he does, and it's inspiring, and really interesting, really smart guy, who runs a really great shop. One cool thing, right? Obviously, generally I have music from my guests at the end of the episode, but that is not something that I could do for this one. So if you go into Josh's shop on West 36th Street, if you're in the city, if you're not in the city, you should come to the city and go to the shop. But if you go to the shop and mention the podcast, he will give you 15% off of repairs and accessories. Not 15% off an instrument, because that's just a lot of money. I mean, you want to buy a $3,000 instrument? That's, you know, math is hard, but it's a good chunk of money. That would be almost $500 off a new instrument. So only off of repairs and accessories. Just mention the podcast, Divergent Paths, and he'll give you 15% off. Again, repairs and accessories. So I hope you enjoy the interview. I had, like I said, a really fun time taping this one. So if you like the podcast, please subscribe and leave a review on iTunes and share it to your friends. And yeah, talk to you next week.
So, take two.
Yes.
No.
Here we are once again on the more serious side of the jackhammering going
on. Oh, God, that's so frustrating.
Dude, we hear it all day long.
Yeah.
Even over the music, people playing, it's just like... And sometimes it shakes the building and you feel like the floor shaking. You're like, is the building going to fall down?
Yeah. And I would imagine that if, like, a floor is shaking, that's not great if you're trying to do, like, any kind of precision anything.
Yeah.
That could be a problem.
It's like soldering in the corner. Not quite that bad. And you end up with burns on your fingers like this.
Oh, that's nice. That's nice.
Yeah.
Well, you know.
Or burns on your hand like
you
this.
And you don't go into any kind of repair work if you want nice, smooth
hands.
It's funny. How many times have I been here? Like, I'm usually in here like once a week.
Sometimes. Usually twice a week because you forget something.
Because I forget something the first time I come in. But today is legitimately the first time I walked up and saw the sign. And I was like, oh my God, the logo. It has a JL in it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's in the shape of an instrument called a cornopean.
Oh, I didn't. There was no way I would know that.
Yeah, but. Which that's the forerunner to the modern cornet. But it's very symmetrical. And since I'm into the old instruments and I find it very like attractive, the curves and stuff. Mm-hmm. That was when I had the logo designed, like some input I gave to the designer, which I thought was pretty cool.
Well, I felt pretty stupid.
That you never saw the sign.
Because I've seen the sign hundreds of times at this point, or the logo on Facebook or whatever. I've seen the logo so many times and I just didn't ever know.
Yeah.
And it's even different colors.
It is.
So you can actually notice it.
Yeah. It's the colors of metal, like an instrument.
Yeah, I know. It's crazy. It makes so much sense.
It had some thought into it.
Yeah. Probably some money, too.
Yeah. A little bit.
People don't design that shit for free. All right. Well, thank you for making time again.
Yes. It's an honor to try this the second time around.
So this is not, you know, you've been doing brass repair for
long time.
A good number of years now. Yeah. How long is it now? Close to 20?
Yeah, it's been over 20 over years 20. Since I started apprenticing as a kid, but it's been full-time every day for the past 14 years. More than 14 years? Yeah.
And wait, you were like apprenticed when you were in like high school or
yeah,
or...
when I was a freshman in high school, guitar was my first instrument, and when I was in middle school, or in elementary school, I played guitar and drums.
Mm-hmm.
And I went to middle school, and there were like 19 drummers in the band class.
Of course.
And the band director says, oh, who wants to play French horn? And I look around the room, and I'm like, wow, there's a lot of other kids who are going to play drums. I'll try.
Yeah.
So French horn, or the band director gave me a French horn, and he's like, here, try it. And I was able to get a note out of it, and I went home and I told my parents, I'm like, I'm gonna play French horn now. And my parents are like, what? I mean, he's got all these guitars, he's got a drum set, he's got this, are you gonna play French horn? Okay. And it turned out that my great grandfather had played French horn in the Russian army, so it was like, wow, that's kind of weird that here I'm now picking French horn.
Yeah.
So in middle school, I would take the band instruments home. And I was a tinker. Like growing up as a kid, I was always taking things apart, whether it be, you know, somebody was throwing away a microwave on the street or a blender or a bicycle or G.I. Joe's, whatever it was, I'd take them apart. So, you know, band room, you know, band director cared but didn't really care about the instruments much.
I mean, and like those instruments, you've usually been there for
a long time and abused,
and they barely work anyway.
And I would take them apart and mess with them and try to enhance them. And when it was time for like high school, my parents and music teachers all got together and said, well, maybe Josh should repair instruments. So my parents went to the music store where I had taken guitar lessons at since I was six and said, give him a job in the repair shop. Don't pay him. Have them do whatever you want, just teach them something.
Yeah.
And that got my start.
And where are you from?
Yeah, St. Petersburg, Florida. So, but there was, you know, I had really great music teachers and everybody was really supportive of me playing and also that tinkering and repairing, fiddling side of things.
Florida has a very underrated music output as far as student wise, you know. I spent 10 years living there when I was growing up, and it was always, you always think of like Texas, New York, wherever, as having like the greatest, you know, all the great bands.
Yeah, and
Florida's like a you know, and the St. Peter, I'm, you know, go down to Tampa, St. Yeah. Petersburg area every year for Allstate. Mm-hmm. Many.
And very familiar. What was the other one? That. Festival of Winds.
Festival of Winds.
That at University of South Florida.
Oh my God. Yeah.
Those are good times.
Yeah. All the states on us, Tallahassee. When you're Cocoa Beach, Jacksonville, yeah. Of course, Tampa.
But where yeah. my, so growing up, my horn teacher, mm-hmm. was a woman named Carolyn Wall, mm-hmm. Has put out amazing students
right.
who've gone on to be other things. So I grew up, and in my youth symphony, there was a guy by the name of James Nickel, who plays, I think now he's playing in Kennedy Center. There was Jonathan Hamill, who was a horn player, who is principal in Tokyo. There was Kevin Rivard, who is a little bit younger than me, who's principal in San Francisco Ballet. There, Jeff Pilkington, who's principal horn in National Opera. So it's like all these, like, and that's just horn players. And not, and then there were trombone players who are in Berlin now, and, you know, all these great musicians from this one little studio, which was pretty awesome.
Yeah, I mean, you're the second person that I've talked to who, like, had experience studying with her, you know, studying with her in that, you know, down there. But yeah, it's really interesting that so many, not just, like you said, not just horn players, yeah, like so many brass players influenced yeah. by this one.
She's just such a nurturing, you know, he was always called her Mama Wall. And she played in the third, she plays third horn in the Florida Orchestra, and she'd always, you know, get us kids, you know, free tickets to the orchestra, and she'd drive us to and there, and then we'd go out to dinner afterwards with people in the orchestra, and it was like, you know, as a kid growing up, and you're like playing French horn, you don't think of jazz and, you know, stuff like that, so it's like orchestra, 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 and that was the coolest thing ever.
Yeah.
And the brass section in the orchestra is an amazing orchestra. Like, even now, if I go home and, you know, they're playing like an outdoor concert or something like right. that, like hearing the brass section, it's like, wow, man, these are like great musicians. And as an adult now and being around great musicians, I even understand more how valuable they were and are to that community and the kids growing up in that. Because, you know, here, if you're like a kid growing up in New York, you know, as a French horn player, it's like, oh, I go to Juilliard pre-college and I study here with Javier Gondola. It's like, Javier's amazing, but there's like so many others, and just to have so many coming out of one little spot was really cool.
Yeah, it's a, like you said, like in New York or any like another big city, you can study with great musicians, but it's the nurturing
yeah.
quality that is frequently lacking just because of the demands on their
right.
time,
right.
you know.
right.
But yeah, I had, you know, I had my own experience similar to that, like, you know, just having someone who will push you in the right direction. Yeah. You know, guide you if you need it.
Yeah, and not come down hard like your parents. And
it's like, you know, you don't want to play. You don't want to play Lebedev. Yeah. Don't play Lebedev.
Yeah.
Play something else. Whereas, you know, other places a little less.
But she always knew if I didn't practice something, you know, we'd go be going through the lesson, and you know, if I practice it, I'd nail it in a lesson. And if I didn't practice something, yeah, I'd like hack through it. And she would say, well, obviously you didn't practice this.
Mm-hmm.
And it would like devastate me.
Yeah.
It's just like, you could hold your head in shame. It's like, oh, the teacher knows.
I'm not mad. I'm disappointed.
Disappointed, yeah. yeah. She didn't quite go like that. That was more reserved for parents.
You're right. But it was, you know, those kind of things can be implied.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Oh, it was implied at times. But with that, I tinkered. And then when I, you know, joined the Marines and was playing in the Marine band, I worked in different shops, you mm-hmm. know, at the Naval School of Music. There were like some people there.
Oh, the Little Creek memories.
Little Creek, man. Nab Little Creek. I was there for 10 months.
Yeah.
Because I hurt my shoulder.
Were you in, you know, one of the division bands?
Yeah, I went to 1st Marine Division Band.
Nice.
And then worked a lot because I hurt my shoulder in the Marines pretty bad, which I couldn't hold a French horn.
Right, of course.
Which, you know, as a Marine, you know, you got your first job as a rifleman, and yeah, then you know, your second job, oh, you're a French horn player. But because of my arm would go numb, and I was, and still even now, like, I can't put my arm up in like a subway and hold it for more than like a minute without mm-hmm. being in excruciating pain. So I worked in like the supply area and like worked with the gunnery sergeant who was the repair guy, and he showed me stuff and then gave me stuff, and I've been doing it ever since. So
I'm interested, just, you know, obviously I'm interested, You're a Marine veteran.
Yeah, I'm Navy veteran. Veteran. Yeah.
But also, my first two private teachers when I was in middle school, I was 10, 11. One was a guy, it was a retired Navy musician who had taught at Little Creek, mm-hmm. and then, he'd retired and he was just teaching a little bit. And then one of my second teacher was while I was studying with him, a teacher, one of the instructors at Little Creek, because my family, oh, cool. We lived in Norfolk, oh, yeah. at the time. And so I would, every week, my parents were in the Navy, so okay. like never any issues getting on the base. So I would do my lessons,
oh, cool.
in the building there. Like around, let's see, 2000, 2001.
Oh, that's when I was there.
Yeah, so.
Wow, that's funny.
Isn't that crazy?
I was there in 99, 2000.
You know, I started studying with him in early 2000.
Who was that?
His name was Doug Winks.
Doug Winks.
Sergeant Army? First Class Doug Winks. Yeah, he was Army.
Name's familiar.
Mm.
Interesting.
He had a picture of Christian Lumber on his studio door and quotes and all this stuff. Anyway, yeah. those little quote-unquote studios. Yeah. Anyway, but I'm always very interested, I've always been interested by because you, of course, there's the bands, the military right. bands. You got your President's Own, your Pershing's Own, your West Point, your
Army Field Band.
Yeah, right. You know, your ones that are basically like, there are as difficult to get into as a symphony orchestra.
Yeah.
If you're a wind player, but people don't often you kind of forget that there's thousands of musicians
in the military yeah.
and who play in these division bands and these wing bands. You mm-hmm. know. And of course, depending on the service, whatever right, they're called. Right.
Fleet bands,
yep. I'm just curious as to why you chose that as an option. I mean, like, because it's...
Well, it wasn't... It was kind of an option, but it wasn't. So I went off to college in Illinois to be a music and engineering major. And I joined a fraternity house, and I partied way too much. And like midterms came along, I'm home on Christmas break. I was getting ready to move into the fraternity house when I came back the next semester, and I knew my grades were bad because I had dropped most of my classes that I was allowed to drop and still have credit hours to stay in school.
Right?
Because I was like partying all the time.
12 credits.
Yeah, I was drinking. I was doing drugs. You know, it was like, oh, freedom. You know, I don't have to do anything. I can like just get trashed. So I didn't pay my phone bill in my dorm because they would not send your grades if you didn't. Oh. So I was like waiting for, to get back to school, pay the phone bill, live in the fraternity house and just party, and my parents wouldn't be so hip. And maybe like 3 or 4 days, maybe a little bit longer than that, before I was supposed to go to back to school, but not much time at all, the grades came in. And I came home one night, and my parents were up, and there's my grades with a 0.8 GPA for the semester. With like 11 credit hours, going from, the 22 that I had started with down to like 11, enough to keep my scholarship. So my parents, needless to say, were very pissed off.
Underwhelmed.
Yeah, yeah. And they said, Joshua, you're ruining your life. You're not going back to school. You're going to move home and you're going to go to community college and get your act together and blah, 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 blah. So me being like 18 and like really having a good time in college. I mean, and I spent like so much money, like all my scholarship money. And
yeah, of course.
I got credit cards because, they like schools give out, It's like, oh, sign up for credit. Dude, tons of debt and just drugs and alcohol and partying. So when I was a kid, a little backstory, my parents were hippies back in the day. And of course, they're now in their late 60s. So they're, they're baby boomers. So their parents were in World War II. So growing up, they were very anti-military and had always said to me, if I failed in life, the military wouldn't take me. So in an argument, when I come home with these like horrible grades and they found out, you're not going back to school, I pretty much said, well, screw you guys, you're not the boss of me, I'm joining the Marines. Because I knew that would really be hurtful to them.
Yeah.
And I stormed out the door and went to the recruiter's office and said, sign me up, I want to play it. I am a French horn player, so it would be great if I could play in the band, but sign me up. So I did that. I signed up and then went back to school and moved all my stuff back home, like shipped it up and or shipped it back down to Florida. And then
off to Paris Island.
Like waited 30 days so I could pass a P test from smoking pot and like went to boot camp. You know, like in March, I was like in boot camp. You know, and this is like January, you go back to school. And so yeah. It's like, you know, there was like a little bit of time to get, mm-hmm. you know, I had to pay off my debt and, you know, certain things. And, you know, I was worked a job doing general contracting and construction right. in that overlap to pay the debt. And still was like partying a little bit before that. But yeah, like 30-day mark, okay. I signed the contract, okay. And yeah, I joined the Marines. And it was a good and bad decision. I would never do it again.
Yeah.
I'm glad I did it. I found out a lot about myself. What, you know, a person is capable of doing. As yeah. I'm sure, you know, you kind of figured out when you were in boot camp, like, oh, I'm getting up at 5 in the morning and I'm going to go run a million miles. And
well, it's
the Navy, so it's a little bit different.
Well, it's not 13 weeks. We're not doing hand-to-hand combat. I mean, yeah. It's very different. But I, you know, from my perspective, like both my parents were in the Navy.
Yeah,
like,
it was.
I knew what I was getting yeah. myself into. I knew what to expect. Anyway, all that. So you started doing. You know, you had been doing the apprentice stuff in high school, and after you injured yourself, they let you. You know, you started.
Yeah, because like, I still had to do something.
Right.
You know, I couldn't be just like a lame duck laying around. you know, fish out of water, flopping well, around, I mean, doing nothing.
They could stick you on a gate.
Well, I did sit a lot of you know, desk duty and other things, but I'm a very resourceful person.
Of course.
So they were like, we're gonna put him in supply. Landris, we need these and we can't get them. And then I'd come back with my truck filled with, you know, we're going out to the field, we need these, and I'd come back and there's a truck full of
this and that, the other thing.
The gunny would be like, I don't want to know how you got those. I'm like, cool. So it kind of worked out to an advantage. But also, you know, I look at it differently. Had I not gotten hurt, and, you know, I was kind of looked at as a malingerer, you know, because when you're in the military, especially in the Marines, it's like that pain is weakness leaving the body, and, you know, you're just pretending to be hurt to get out of things. And the doctors really couldn't figure out what was wrong with my shoulder.
Mm-hmm.
But yet, I was in excruciating pain all the time. I was taking 3,600 milligrams of Motrin a day to get through the day. I mean, that's like an obscene amount. And then other painkillers and anti-inflammatories and different drugs on top of that, just to function.
You thought you were going to have to stop doing drugs when you joined.
Yeah, man.
You were wrong.
Man, I was like, okay, let's give you this and this and this. But had I not gotten hurt, I think I would have made a career as a military musician. I mean, mm-hmm. there were things I really liked about it. And even now, there's things I miss about it.
Me too. And I look back,
you know, I'll be at the bar at night and, you know, I'll reminisce and be like, yeah, so when I was back in the Marines, you know. I kind of dug on some of that stuff, but I guess in the long term it turned out better that I did.
Yeah, I mean,
because my unit was deployed to Iraq, and since it was a division band, and
well, I remember talking to, you know, one of the all state years. I think maybe my junior year of high school, I went down to the FMEA, blah 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 blah, and I was, of course, all the services. Yeah. They're not recruiters.
They're
telling, you know, and being like, you know, going and talking to the Marine guys, and then being like, yeah, you know, the bands get deployed, and when they're not in rehearsal and doing their thing, they're doing rear guard security, and mm-hmm. I'm like, is that a selling point? I mean, this is
that what, doesn't sound like fun.
Well, I mean, me being from the uber patriotic,
mm-hmm.
you know. Background that I'm from, I had no issues with that. But at the same time, I'm like, is that what you're really trying to sell a bunch of high schoolers on in 2005? Like, that in the middle of like gnarly shit? Yeah. Like that's really what we're going for. But anyway, that's it's just an interesting way to look at recruiting people.
It really is.
How long, you know, did they eventually boot you out for the, you know, because of the injury or
little? It was like 2 years and 9 months.
Mm-hmm.
It was 2 years 9 months around that. Because it was like, well, we can't figure out what's wrong with you. So we're done. So we'll give you a disability. We'll get you out. But like, as soon as I got out, you know, I go to like a real orthopedist and, you know, they do an MRI and a CAT scan and x-rays and they're like, yeah, this is what's wrong. Let's do surgery. And they did like a major shoulder surgery. And I had had a surgery also when I was at Little Creek, I had a shoulder surgery. But they didn't correct everything.
Right.
So I had like all this scar tissue and I had a torn bicep tendon and I had a torn labrum, like all these things that are like really big issues. But had they, you know, at least had a competent doctor then in the military, they would have figured it out.
Right.
But they didn't have competent doctors. It's like, okay, we're going to do physical therapy for rotator cuff. It's like, well, I just had my rotator cuff fixed. So obviously it's not that.
Yeah.
But, well, let's give him more painkillers. You know, it's just muscle strain because he's a pussy. Yeah, you know.
Thanks.
It's like, thanks.
Thanks, doc.
So, yeah, when I got out, I, like, got surgeried up and, you know, that was better.
Mostly
better. Yeah. I mean, I've since destroyed my shoulder again and need another, like, big surgery where the doctor's like, yeah, you're going to be in a sling for 6 months. And I'm like, well, that doesn't really work for me in my job.
Yeah.
And, yeah. You know, 9 months recovery time? Okay. Yeah, I would be out of business.
Yeah,
so I've been postponing this for years and years and years and years, but I think this summer or this fall I want to like get my shoulder fixed. Because I got like a little kid at home now. Mm-hmm. So, you know, like holding the kid in my left arm, like 5-6 minutes and I'm like dead. Or I was out with, I was driving with some friends and to go somewhere in their like SUV and they have two kids and you know there's all these and I'm like reaching in the back, you know, over my left side, I'm in the passenger seat to reach all the way to the third row where my wife is sitting with the kid to hand something and I dislocated my shoulder, which happens frequently, and I'm just like pop it right back in,
which is not something that really should happen.
No, it shouldn't, but it happens frequently. Like I did it once while driving. I'm like trying to take off a jacket and on my way to Thanksgiving dinner at my in-laws, and I'm like sitting in the FDR in traffic, and I'm like,
okay.
Oh man, I'm gonna take my jacket off. And, oh crap, I just dislocated my shoulder, and it's like, okay, let me pop it back in. The traffic's moving.
It's really interesting. You know, it's actually, I've found it's like fairly common for people who end up in, well, what is obviously where they should have ended up because something like terrible habit. So, yeah. Like, yeah, it's really,
it's that life altering decision making point.
That inflection point that is just like, well, I mean, I could tough it out, or
yeah, I had the option to, you know, like stay in the military and, you know, oh well, we can see if we can fix you. And I'm like, well, you know, it's been all this time and you haven't fixed me. And you know, my thing was, it's like, look, I don't want to, you know, be an old man and not able to use my arm because when I was 19, 20, 21, I screwed up my shoulder in the military and I just, you know, suffered through it.
Yeah.
Now, granted, I'm suffering through it now, but it's for a much better purpose than like being in the damn military, you know? And nothing against, you know, people who serve in the military and, you know, are hurt and disabled from what's going on. But I didn't want to be, as a French horn player, like, like screwed up for playing French horn in the band and not getting surgery when I needed it.
It's a little bit of a different.
A little different.
You know. So you kind of, you know, you kept your tinkering chops, if you will, up while you were still in the service.
Yeah, yeah.
And when you got out, like,
so when I got out, I went back to school.
I mean, you're, at that point, you're still like really young.
Yeah, I was 21.
Yeah, I mean.
I didn't repair when I moved back. I moved back home to Florida to my parents and went back to school and used some GI Bill and got a job working at a law firm as like a file clerk, paralegal assistant.
You didn't move into the frat?
No. It's, you know, community college, but it was a 4-year community college. Kind of weird. But after like the military stuff, and I'm like, I think I want to just repair brass instruments for a full time. I really like doing that. I opened up the Yellow Pages and I called every music store in the phone book and said, you know, quick, hi, my name is Josh Landris. I recently got out of the Marine Corps band. While I was in the Marines, I served as a French horn player and as a brass repair specialist. Do you have any positions for a repair technician? Mm-hmm. And everybody said no. And I called up Sam Ash Music, because they had like a couple stores in my area. And they said, well, you know, we don't offer repairs here, but we'll give your number to the guy up in the corporate office in Long Island, New York, and you can talk to him. So I called this guy and, you know, gave him like the quick, you know, spiel. And he says, well, you know, we don't have anybody down there, but if you'd like, we can hire you as a salesman in the Clearwater store. And, you know, you could start to do, you know, part-time repairs and build a repair shop there. I'm like, yeah, I don't really want to do sales. He's like, well, you know, we have a, you know, our head brass guy who's been at the company for 35 years in Long Island is retiring. And we need somebody to replace him, and we don't have anybody working repairs in our Manhattan store. So I'm like, okay, cool. And so we talked a little bit more. And finally, I proposed to them. I said, okay, here's what I propose. I'm going to come up to New York at my own expense. I will work for you guys for a week. And then if you like my work, and I think that this is a good fit, I'll move to New York and come and work for you. And that's what I did. I came to work. I moved up from Florida for $8 an hour.
Did you, and you've never, like, had you been to New York? Did you, like, I mean, other
yeah,
than
yeah, I've been,
like,
my dad's from Long Island,
okay.
So I, like,
okay, so it wasn't
so
like
I stayed with, like, my dad's childhood best friend and his family, and, you know, it's, like, kids
it,
my age that I grew
but
up
But it wasn't
with.
Quite the get off the bus with your suitcase
no,
and your eyes
no, no, no.
full of dreams.
No. I mean, I came up to do a job interview.
Right.
So I worked for a week, and then after that week that they didn't pay me, they were like, oh, we pulled a fast one on this kid. They got a week of free work. They offered me a job for $8 an hour. And I'm like, okay, I'll take it.
Was that, and was that like 40 hours a week at $8 an
yeah,
hour?
Yeah, that was 40 hours a week. And it was working in Long Island doing rental instrument, school rental repairs, and quality controlling very crappy Chinese instruments. And I mean like very crappy, like, oh, let's go through these 1,000 trumpets that came in. Oh, none of the valves are numbered. Awesome. Okay, let's take them out and stamp 1, 2, and 3 on 3,000 valves. Stuff like that. And the guy who was there as their like head brass guy, as I look at it, was a horrible repairman. I called him the butcher. This guy could make something look cosmetically beautiful. But he filed and he sanded and he pushed and he sanded and he buffed and like destroyed the shit out of instruments.
But it sure looks
which
good.
Was okay for like rentals because, you know, like, oh, this kid's getting this, you know, 40-year-old Bundy that is not anything in the what the specs should be. And it's got, you know, sanded slides and, you know, guy doesn't do any type of chemical cleaning at any, just sands things clean. But they look brand new.
Mm-hmm. And, well, and, you know, to be fair, that looks really, you know, if you're a parent.
Yeah,
like
if you're a parent, no,
you
it's
see
great.
That, it looks
it's
amazing.
Great. But if you're a professional musician, and, you know, I was a professional musician, that didn't really fly with me. And I learned a lot of things from him, but at the same time, I learned more of what not to do.
Which can be just as valuable.
Just as valuable, yeah. I mean, it's like, you know, like when you grow up as a kid and you touch the stove and your mom's like, don't touch the stove, it's hot. And then when you burn your hand after you touch the stove, it's like, oh, I learned what not to do now.
Yeah.
It was that type of awakening with me. And I worked with him for like a year and a half, almost 2 years. And then he retired and I took over for him. And I did all the repairs that they had. And then there was nothing for me to do because I was so hungry to like work. I was working, you know, I'd come in at like 7 in the morning and work until 5, 6 o'clock at night. And I just worked a lot. So I did all the rental repairs, like thousands of instruments a season. Did them all. Quality controlled. All the stuff done. And I'm like, hey, I need work to do or I'm just going to go home. And they're like, well, you can't go home. You need to work. You need to work. So then they started sending me to like the stores in the tri-state area that didn't have repair shops to clean out the basements. And I go through all the instruments and bring them in my truck back to Long Island and work in the shop. And then I'm like, okay, I'm done with all this stuff. So when they were on 48th Street, they had a guy was a very talented saxophone repairman named Anthony Salimbini. He was like the repairman there, but he wasn't doing brass. And it was like a small, tiny, little, shitty room that he was doing repairs in. And he didn't want to share that space with anybody. So he had quit. So I'm like, well, guys, you know, you hired me to work in New York City. And you've had me in this warehouse in Long Island doing shit. Granted, I've honed my chops really well doing all this stuff. But I want to work in New York.
Yeah.
So then
And come on, for decades, 48th Street
was like Music Row.
Music Row, I mean, and that's where everybody
went. Was
Broadway orchestra, like rock stars, down to students. There's one left.
There's none.
There's none left.
They're all gone.
The last one closed.
Last
a few
one was
ago,
an accordion shop. Yeah,
right.
Everything's gone.
It's really depressing.
It's
yeah, because you got all the music shops on one end, you got the Union on the other end, and then you got Broadway in the middle.
Yeah, it's sad. So what happened, I then, you know, started, like one day a week, I'd go to 48th Street and work, and then 4 days a week in Long Island. And then it was 2 days a week on 48th Street and 3 days in Long Island. Then it was 3 days on 48th Street and 3 days. I started going to 6 days a week. Then it was 4 days a week, one day in Manhattan or one day in Long Island. And the progression came to where I was working like 6 days a week, 7 days a week in Manhattan, and then going to Long Island like twice a month. And then eventually it's like, okay, I'm not going to come to Long Island anymore and do this bullshit work. And I worked with, you know, a couple, there were a lot of woodwind technicians in and out of that shop. And, you know, like when you work in a shop, whether it's working with somebody new or somebody who's been doing it a long time, or if it's, you know, a clarinet specialist or a saxophone specialist or a brass specialist, there's things that you can learn from other craftsmen, good or bad. Kind of like musicians, you know, you can learn if you're a trombone player, you're a bass trombone player, you can learn something from a violin player or an oboist about musicality, about the music, about how to breathe, about playing, sound, you know. So I learned from people who I worked with, and I spent, when it was full-time in New York, my first like 2 years, I didn't take a vacation. And I worked 7 days a week. Because I lived on 42nd and 9th, and I was working on 48th and 7th. So it's like an easy walk. I'm just like, I'm going to get to work. And then I go to work. And I come home. And I go to work. And I come home. I go out and party. And I go to work. Because I like working on instruments.
Yeah.
So I just like...
didn't even phase
me. And they paid me overtime. And so it was like, well, man, it's really stupid. They're going to let me work as many hours as I want.
I'm
going to work 65, 70 hours a week. No problem. And that's what I did. And that lasted 11 years. Yeah, I worked for Sam Ash for 11 years. Wow. And that was a long time. It was good for many years. And then it just kind of went down.
Well, I mean, with the kind of... I only went to Sam Ash once when I was still on 48th Street. And that was... 2012? So it was late 2012.
Yeah,
so
that was after I had already left.
It was legit, like, right before they closed it.
Yeah.
I was living on 34th Street between 9th and 10th, so obviously...
It's super quick.
That's... Well, and when I was living there is when they bought the space they have now.
Well, they're renting that.
Or rented the space that they have now. And, well, and built the store there.
Yeah.
But I mean, like, it's a huge corporation, and yeah, it's...
Well, the difference with me and them is I wanted to cater to professional musicians. I wanted to build something that was not just like, oh, this was like, we're going to just have this, you know, our in-house brand and our Chinese stuff.
And they cast such a huge net.
Oh, yeah.
You know, they want, like, someone who's never even seen an instrument before. And the guys who have been professionals for 40 years.
Right.
And
but the professionals, always, you know. Like the business kind of trickled down in the professional because, you know, there's, as a business owner, I now kind of understand, there is like no money to be made selling new expensive instruments.
Yeah.
It's like, you know, if I make $300 on a $3,500 instrument or a $3,000 instrument, that's like my profit margin on new instruments. It's like you can't pay, you know, especially for them and, you know, having like 50 stores, you can't really make a business model on that. So I wanted to cater more towards the professional repair. I wanted to grow the business, and they weren't willing to invest into that.
And when it comes to, and not even just in music, but any kind of repair aesthetic, whether that's cars, whether that's instruments, whatever it is, like, you know, a lot of time, the best experience you have with a craftsman is a personalized experience where they understand what you do and what you want, and you can provide that with and I don't know, with a larger company.
I was completely able to do that, like one-on-one work with a customer. But I'll give you an example. It's like the one building that we were in. So Sam Ash had a bunch of buildings, right? So the Brass and Wind store that I was in for, that was there for many years, was one day condemned. Like, we all came in to work, and like city officials came in with hard hats on and said, the building's condemned, everybody has to be out in 15 minutes. Like, what the fuck? Like, what do you mean we all have to be out in 15 minutes? The building is in imminent danger of falling down, everyone must leave.
Awesome.
Great. So then they shut down the store. And then like a couple days later, we were able to go in and move all our stuff out, but we had like one day to get everything out of the store. So they moved the store like across the street to where the DJ equipment was, and they set up like a very small Brass and Winds counter. And they put the repair shop up three flights of stairs into like an office room. So that meant like lathes and, you know, all the repair stuff had to go up three flights of stairs. So if you've ever moved like a 1,500 pound lathe up three flights of stairs on a hand truck, the lathe's going to get screwed up.
I mean, I've never done that personally, but...
No, it got screwed up. And then they wouldn't put lighting in the room for like a month. It's like, we need overhead lights because you need to see when you're repairing. And this was both brass and woodwinds and string repairmans with no lights. So they're like, well, this is temporary. We're going to find a new home and blah, 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 blah. So then they moved us again like 4 or 5 months later. They closed the guitar store and the guitar store moved into Manny's. And they merged. They closed down the Manny's brand. And then the Brass and Winds moved into what the guitar store was. And then we moved the shop to the second floor. So then I had to move like lathe down three flights of stairs again and up and another floor. Like when you do that, it's like a chassis of a car. If a chassis of a car gets bent, it's totaled.
Yeah.
You know, even if like cosmetically on the outside, it's perfect. This lathe was like that. But they didn't want to invest in a new lathe. And it's like, look, guys, $2,000. That's all we're talking about. You've had $20,000 of instruments stolen this month, and you won't spring for like $2,000 on a lathe?
On a lathe.
But that was also because there were people who worked for that company who were repairmen over the years who ripped them off.
Yeah.
Because it's very easy as like, the way they had it set up, I could sit there and like order parts and tools and equipment at one point all day until I was blue in the face. And somebody ordered hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of stuff that they stole. So after that, they're like, you know, fuck repairmen. Fuck that.
Yeah.
We don't want to waste the money. And that was over.
Mm-hmm.
So when that move, that transition of moves happened, it became not a good place to work.
Yeah.
It was even, you know, I was, as far as like a monetarily bringing in into the company, Sam Ash had, so they had like 48 stores at the time. They had 20 plus Brass and Wind technicians around the country working. And my like monthly and then annual like numbers that I was bringing in was more than like the next 15 people down combined next to me. So you take 2 to 15, their income that they were bringing in didn't match
mine. Right.
So I went to the executives. Everything had to get approval. I said, I would like an apprentice. And I had had apprentices, and, you know, then they fired apprentices, and, you know, things didn't work out. And I'm like, I've got people who are willing to work for free, who want to come and work and learn repair and be here on 48th Street. And their answer was, well, if you can show that you can double your numbers, we'll let you have an apprentice. Like, what type of asinine, like, thought is that? So here's somebody who's your number one earner, 15 times more than the next 15 people, and you have to double the numbers first to...
To get an unpaid intern.
An unpaid intern? So after that, that was kind of like
the deciding
factor. And then there was like a rumor of, oh, well, Sam, you know, we're losing the leases on these buildings and we're going to have to move. So I went to the owner, Jerry Ash, who's a very, very nice man. He's now like, I think, 90 years old. And I had a very good relationship with him. He had taught me accordion repair. like old school guy. Like, you know, this is the man who built the company. The eldest son of the original Sam Ash. And I went to him and I said, Jerry, you know, this is what I would like to do when this move happens. I would like to have a professional shop that's well outfitted. I'd like to have several people working here. I would like to bring in these products. And I was helping the buyer of the company buy brass products. And I went to China for them and worked at instrument factories and designed instruments for them. I was doing a lot of stuff. And I said, this is what I want to do. And this can make a lot of money. He says, well, I'll talk to the, you know, the kids. Because he didn't really have the deciding clout right. anymore. Being, he was like 82 or 83 at the time. And his kids had... Or like the CEO and mm-hmm. the vice president and the general counsel. And, you know, it had like that whole structure.
Yeah.
And it completely got shot down. Because the kids looked at Brass and Winds as like, eh, it's not really. Money's in guitars and DJ equipment. Which it is.
They're not wrong.
They're not wrong. I mean,
but
if you want
to keep a high level.
But when one says like a French horn mouthpiece is a novelty item, I mean, it's like, I'm saying buy expensive French horns and you're saying a mouthpiece is a novelty item. So that sparked me to work on a business plan and start looking for places and opening up the shop.
Right. So you opened your own store in...
2012.
Right. Yeah. So...
I got married in June 2012. went on my honeymoon with my wife. I burned all my vacation time. I came back, and I had been working on a business plan for probably about 2 years, like a detailed 5-year, you know, drawn out numbers, projections, you know, like what you would do to start a real business. I did that, and then come back from my honeymoon, and I started looking for spaces. And it's kind of very odd requirements that I was looking for. I wanted to be in Midtown.
Of course.
I wanted to be west of 6th Avenue. I wanted to be between 34th Street and 50th Street, and I didn't want to be further west than 9th Avenue.
Well, I mean, to an outsider, that might seem odd, but
to a musician, that makes sense.
To a freelance brass player, that makes perfect sense.
It's like,
sense.
Okay, I can get there from Brooklyn, I can get there from Queens, I can get there from New Jersey, I can get there from the Met, I can get there from Manhattan School, I can get there from Manus.
Or if I... If I need to just swing by
between
for 15
shows,
minutes
right.
between or before between
there's times
before I go play Lion King before you know
right. So I had and then I wanted my own bathroom. I needed running water besides the bathroom. I needed concrete floors to make noise and have machinery. And then I needed a place that wasn't office space because people wanted to play instruments.
Right.
So I probably looked at 50 to 60 spaces.
Well, and
within my budgetary range, and I found in this building, I was up on the 5th floor, and you know it was like 800 usable square feet, and I saw it, and it used to be like a massage parlor, so they had all these like private booth rooms set up, and I'm like looking at the big picture, I'm like, wow, this would be perfect. It's concrete floors. There's a bathroom. There's an extra water line here, an extra drainage that's not next to the bathroom. This will be the shit. So it was in my price range. It was like $3,500 a month in rent. So for a startup, that's like, okay,
yeah,
that's like awesome.
It's doable.
It's doable. And so I signed the lease and I gave my notice at Sam Ash in August.
it's a good summer.
Yeah,
good
so it was like, yeah, it was a good summer. It was a stressful summer.
Yeah.
You know, I'm like, oh, I'm a newlywed, now I'm going to open my own business. Awesome. So I borrowed money from some family members and a friend, and my wife and I used all our wedding gift money and put that into the business to start it up.
It's nice of her to let you do that.
Yeah. I owe her. She's like, you know, whenever I like talk about the shop and, you know, like big decision makings, like expanding into this space, you know, she's like, well, you know, I am a stockholder. Like, well, yeah, you know, it's sort true. Of. Yep. for a little bit of seed money.
Yeah.
But I don't regret it most days.
Most.
And it's a stressful job.
Well, I mean, you run an extremely busy
shop. I'm here.
Very busy shop. I mean.
So now that I have the kid, I don't work as much as I used to. But when I was, before the kid, I was working. I was here 6 days a week, sometimes seven. And I was working. I'd come in at 7:30, 8 in the morning and work until 1, 2 in the morning. 6 days a week.
That's a lot of.
Yeah. it was a lot. And now with the kid, I'm still here. I get in like between 8 and 9 in the morning, depending on the day of the week. And most days I leave at 10 o'clock, sometimes a little later. Fridays I duck out early because I want to spend time with the family, and I don't work weekends anymore.
Yeah.
But I'm still putting in a 14, 15 hour day 4 days out of the week.
Yeah.
Which sucks.
So as just as from the perspective of being, you know, obviously there's the businessman side, but just from like being a crafts person, mm-hmm. a craftsman, like I had this worded really well in my head and then it just all just disappeared. well, cause you do, while, you know, this is a shop, mm-hmm. you know, tailored for professional musicians.
Yeah.
You know, but that does, you know, you get high schoolers, you get,
sure.
you know.
Get everybody.
And you're like, why wouldn't, you know.
Yeah, and I don't turn anybody away. That's a 10-year-old who wants to play trumpet or trombone or French horn.
Just as valid
because they might be in 20 years or 15 years playing on Broadway or, you know, in a symphony or something. And I don't want to be, you know, well, you know, little Timmy, I recommend you not playing trumpet.
Yeah, that's...
No, man, it's... You know, I want to nurture
but that, too. But this is... but, you know, overall, it's a very, very personalized... brass players are very touchy about their instruments.
Yeah.
You know, and... well, because... And, you know, you deal with, like, all the top Broadway guys. You deal with the guy, you know, in the Met section. Mm-hmm. And you know, pretty much everyone.
Dude, yeah.
Like all the professional, all the guys, they come here.
Yeah.
Like most brass players are gearheads.
Yeah.
And how do you kind of like, I would imagine there are like differences of opinions.
Sure.
At times.
There's, so I look at my job as like.
Oh, duh, Landers, he's this fucking horn player. Like, what does he know about like really repairing a Thayer valve?
Yeah. Well, you know, you work on things over and over and over. The craft, like the principles of repair from one instrument to another in brass is all the same.
Mm-hmm.
It's just on different scales. You know, so taking a dent out of a trumpet is like taking the dent out of a trombone, is like taking the dent out of a euphonium, like taking a dent out of a
hood of a car.
It's all the same principles. As long as you know how to do it in the steps, it's just on a larger scale. But my job is, it's like part therapist, it's part friend, it's part businessman, it's craftsman. And my approach on business in the shop is not necessarily, you know, gouge. It's like one-time customers, you know, which is a lot of, like, in the music industry now, you know, a lot of companies or websites or stuff, you know, they just want to get that sale and then out the door. I often, and I think I've probably done it for you, why do you need that mouthpiece? You come in and like, oh man, you know, I'm thinking about trying out, why? You know, Dan, why do you need another mouthpiece?
You've never done that to me, mostly because I'm not a mouthpiece
but
guy.
I have people who come in. So there's a trumpet player in town who's been going through the mouthpiece search recently, as we all kind of gone through and go through from time to time. And he told me he bought like 40 mouthpieces on eBay and, you know, one of the trumpet forums and stuff. And then he's coming in here and he's had, you know, Bob Reeves do some custom work on a mouthpiece. And then he's coming in here and looking at mouthpiece. I'm like, dude. Like,
you have a problem.
I'm like, what are you doing? Like, I'm more than happy to sell you a mouthpiece, but I'm not going to because you don't know what you need. And I'm not going to be like, you know, pushing product on you just to pay the rent. I'd rather you come in when you need something and you know what you want. And if I don't have it, you know, try to work with you. But it's, you know, some people are harder to figure out what they want to do musically with the equipment.
Mm-hmm.
And some people are so in tune with their instrument, you know, like if you play 4 hours, if you're practicing 4 hours a day outside of gigging and stuff like that, you know the nuances of your horn.
Yeah.
And you know how the equipment feels on your face. And you know when, hopefully, if you're having a bad chop day or it's the equipment. But not everybody knows those types of things at times.
You know, obviously, my teacher, my former teacher, comes up in a comical way
mm-hmm.
regularly because he is he asks for a lot from Edwards, from Griego, from whoever. Yep. But on the other hand, it's, you know, to what you're saying, like it's because he has such an intimate knowledge of how everything right. feels.
Yeah, yeah.
When he's playing,
yeah. There are people so sensitive out there. Like if you move the brace. Like a tenth of a millimeter, they would feel that change. Because anything and everything you do changes the way an instrument will play.
Mm-hmm.
Or how it takes the air, or how it responds, or how it vibrates. And some people are that sensitive. And like in his case, for example, the guy is a beast of a player. You could give him a garden hose with a funnel on it, and he would sound like $1 million. But that's not what he needs to do his job to mm-hmm. the best of the ability. So what I'm trying to do now is be that source to give musicians what they need to do their job the best so mm-hmm. that they can make great music and make a living at it and, you know, not have to fight the equipment, so to speak, so that they can be more musical in things. And that's kind of really my goal. That and also to make something that will last.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like when I make a part or I make an instrument or, you know, something. It's like, man, I collect stuff from the mid-19th century. Like, I collect stuff from 1840s and 1850s. Like, those guys back then were making, they weren't thinking that, you know, somebody 160, 170, 180 years later is going to be looking at that stuff saying, oh, man, this is really cool. Yeah. Like, I've got this Bessin cornet from 1848, man. Holy shit. They weren't thinking about that. They were like, well, I want to improve the intonation and make this the finest instrument and have everyone playing my instruments, which yeah. is cool. But now, like, I look at it and it's like, man, if I make something and it doesn't get destroyed or run over by a car or in a fire, that's going to last, you yeah. know? That's really cool to have something that will last throughout the years. It's like doing a recording. Like once you record music, that's there, man. That's history.
Yeah.
That will be there for future generations as long as we don't blow ourselves up or become zombie mutants. That will last forever.
Yeah.
You know, and that to me is really cool.
Just think about it. This podcast will be on iTunes.
Man.
Forever.
Forever.
Because the iCloud never gets rid of anything.
Oh, yeah. That's kind of scary at the same time. Yeah, a lot of kids don't understand that now. They put the videos up and it's like, really?
You put have you learned nothing from athletes and television personalities? But anyway, but of course what you're saying is much more positive.
Yeah, yeah.
I try
to keep it positive most of the time. I mean, sometimes I am human. I mean, I can be grouchy at times and
sure.
That's one of my biggest fears is becoming bitter. You know, it's like everybody comes in and good or bad, I have over the years built a reputation for like walk-ins and get it done while mm-hmm. you wait if I can. And sometimes, man, that stuff really drives me crazy. You know, like the other day, yesterday, we were short-staffed because Atisa is out at auditions and Matt was doing rehearsals and so-and-so was here and so-and-so leaves early and whatever. And there was all of a sudden a rush where there were like 9 or 10 people all standing around waiting for something to get fixed while they waited.
Mm.
And it's like, I just want to like, if I had hair, I'd pull it out because it's like, you know, it's like, you know, I feel like I'm getting tug of war with my body. And that makes me pretty crotchety at times. And you know, sometimes it shows and I don't like it when it does that.
Mm-hmm.
But Everybody does that. But that's my like biggest fear in the whole world is like becoming a crotchety but, asshole. But
I mean, doesn't that, I mean, that, I guess that, that kind of comes along with being the guy that everyone goes to.
Yeah, but it's, I mean, I want to be here to help people. But, you know, like, you go to like the Midwest somewhere and you go to the repair shop that does the school band repairs and maybe works with the local orchestra players and stuff like that. They don't have like walk-in business like we do here, because there's just such a congestion of musicians in one spot that just the sheer numbers means more people come in. There's a very, 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 very good brass craftsman. There's a couple around the country that I really look up to. One is named Dan Oberlo, and he's in Seattle. He's a amazing craftsman, like low brass tuba specialist, restorer. I mean, the guy's really amazing. And we talk frequently. And, you know, I'll tell him like when I have a crazy day, because it's hard to vent to somebody. And I was talking to him about like the walk-in business. And I said, yeah, man, you know, on like a busy day, we can see like 30 people in a day. And he's like, I haven't seen... This was like maybe like a Friday or something. He's like, I haven't seen more than 3 people this whole week walking in. Because people like send them the stuff. So that makes it, you know, here with the momentum of like people coming in and getting the work done, it puts a lot of stress.
Well, and it's a little bit of a different situation because the sheer amount of musicians who are gigging every night.
Yeah, and like, depend on their instruments.
Yeah, they depend on their instruments to pay their rent and put food in their kids' mouths. Like, yeah. You know, if some, like, well, just like the horn where you're, from the guy in ABT.
Yeah.
Like,
tripped over his
horn. And
his bass trombone, and it's like.
And the season starts on Monday.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, and
they're in rehearsals, and it's like, hey, man, do you have another bass trombone? Because, like, I fixed the bell was pretty crumpled, but the slide, I mean, it was like, canted and bent, and, you know, the whole thing had to be taken apart. That's not something I could just do in, like, the 20 minutes you have between your rehearsal now at and, you know, your break while you're at the Mena Center.
Yeah.
But, you know, I'm going to stay tonight, and I'm going to get that done. So at least, you know, tomorrow morning I can come in and finish up whatever I need to do so he has his slide for tomorrow.
Yeah.
So that stuff, you know, that puts in the long hours.
Yeah.
Or, you know, the emergencies that are, you know... important, and it's all important to me, but it's more important to, you know, the musician who's making their living on their instrument. Like, you can't take that away from somebody, so that's a really difficult thing on trying to juggle. And even with the guys, you know, they deal with it really well, where it's like, okay, I know you're working on this and it's due, but put this off to the side because we got to get this done now.
Yeah.
And that puts a lot of stress on everybody here.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it's like one of the only places probably in the country that you could do that and not have to set up an appointment to get stuff done.
Yeah. That's, well, and you, and I mean, it's funny, like, yeah, it causes a lot of stress, but, you know, the fact that you will do that for people, like, I mean, that makes... The fact that you will even consider doing that for people means that people will can trust you and will come in and be like, yeah, if I am like in a really bad spot, I can get this.
Yeah, I'll stop what I'm doing and try to take care of people. Which just means, you know, I got to make up the time. And then, you know, people like to tell stories.
Yeah.
You know, people come and they want to hang out and talk and, you know, that's cool. But at the same time, like, if I'm hanging out and, like, talking to somebody for, like, a half an hour...
Yeah.
That means I got to make up that half an hour sometime.
Yeah.
So that's going to be at night. So that's where, like, the 15-hour days come in.
And oh, no, like, I mean, and definitely I've been in here times where it was, like, you know, you hang for a few minutes and you get your thing done and then you finish. And then it's kind of like, oh, yeah, it's time for me to go now. They got to do their thing. Like, and it's not, like, any kind of a rude anything. It's just like... No, this is how
it's like,
is.
Hey man, sorry, I gotta get to work, you know.
Yeah. And it's never been so explicitly said. It's just like, you get it.
Well,
you know?
Sometimes I do have to say it to people.
Yeah.
You know, there's a gentleman today picking up an instrument that, you know, was just a standard cleaning on a cornet. And it was like during lunchtime, so everybody was kind of stepped out, and it was just me and one other person. in the shop, and he was eating lunch. So I'm like, okay, I'll take... And the guy wanted to talk for like 40 minutes. He's like, well, you know, I'm from, you know, back in New Haven, and when I went to college, and like the dude's 60s, and he's talking about like playing in college bands. When he was in college, it's like, you know, man, look, I really want to hear your story, and I appreciate the time and you telling me. But that 35, 40 minutes that you just, like, talked my ear off, I'm going to have to make that time up sometime. And it's like 3 o'clock and I haven't eaten lunch.
Yeah.
Or like yesterday, I didn't eat lunch. I didn't eat breakfast either. I came in, I went to work, like, somebody buzzed the door before we were open. Like an hour and change before we opened. Yeah. So it's like, okay, I'm just going to work all day. I got out of here like 9:30 and got breakfast on the way home from work.
Well, see, now you're making me feel bad because you're going to have to make up this time.
Dude, it's fine. You know, it's part of the job. You know? I wouldn't do it if I didn't like doing this stuff.
Yeah.
And I like hearing the stories from people, you know, and I feel honored that people come in here, you know, like if somebody comes in my door, they deserve our time. Mm-hmm. Whether it's my time, my employee's time, they deserve someone's time.
Mm-hmm.
And not all the time. Now I'm trying to phase out ads. There's more and more work and there's more retail and the business is getting bigger. I'm trying to phase out me having to greet everybody and answer every phone call.
Yeah.
Because people will call up and they'll be like, oh, I want to speak to Josh. And, you know, one of my employees will say, well, is there something I can help you with? No, I need to speak to Josh. And they're like, okay, well, let me stop what I'm doing. I'll pick up the phone. This is Josh. Can I help you? Yeah, I have a trumpet that I want to get fixed. There's a loose brace on it. Yeah, man, you know, no problem. Bring it in. What's your address and what time? It's like...
It's online, man.
It's like, yo, man, you could say that to somebody who works here. Because if somebody works here, I obviously trust them to be here.
I mean, let's be honest. I mean, like, Rich has his problems, but he's capable of giving an address.
Mm-hmm.
Just kidding. If Rich hears this, I love you.
Yeah.
But
he's a little squirrel brain. We make fun of him about that. But, you know, stuff like that is one of my biggest generators of stress.
Mm-hmm.
Is just the time management. And it's hard, man, because like I'm coming in at, you know, 8:30 in the morning and I'm starting to work. By the time the guys get in at 10:45, I've already been working for 2 hours.
Mm-hmm.
Or, you know, the time somebody comes in at 11, hey, man, I've already been here 2.5 hours working.
Yeah.
Or, you know, it's like 5 o'clock in the afternoon. Dude, I've already put in a full work day.
Yeah.
You know, and I'm gonna stay here until 10 o'clock tonight. You know, so ease off a little bit.
Well, so I mean, you have how many employees do you have?
There's six.
Six, you know, all musicians.
Yep.
Most of
brass
them,
players.
All brass players. All of them successful. Most of
all but one are like, gigging players.
Yeah.
So everybody, with the exception of Kevin. Because Kevin is like really my only full-time guy.
Mm-hmm.
Because everybody gigs or teaches or, you know, subs or whatever. Kevin and I are the only ones here that are repairing full-time.
Mm-hmm.
As like our only source of income is working here. Like Jesus has the Shim Sham and
his gigs. Gaz
is subbing on Broadway, or he has Radio City. Or Rich teaches a lot of kids, so he, you know, like 3 days out of the week it's like half days because he goes and like teaches in the Bronx. He has private students on the Upper East Side. Atis is finishing, you know, school, and you know he'll be subbing, and he's like, you know, he's not in these next couple of days because he was taking the Baltimore audition.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, that type of stuff doesn't, you know, it works. But at the same time, it's like, you know, everybody's kind of part-time.
Yeah.
But I say, you know, look, you want to come in at 9 in the morning and work with me at 9 in the morning? You're more than welcome to come in and work. And I will pay you overtime. You want to work 6 days a week? By all means, I will allow you and I will pay you for it.
Yeah.
But everybody's got life and musicians, and that's
you know, and it's it's nice to come in to a shop and see guys working who you know from who you play with.
Who you play with.
Like guys you know are really good musicians. Yeah. And it's interesting. If you know someone is really good in one area of their life, you generally trust them more in other areas that you might not have as much. I've played with Matt. Mm-hmm. Let's use him as an example. I played with Matt on a few different things, you know, gigs, Patriot Brass, whatever it is. And, you know, I know he's an incredible trumpet player. Amazing. Absolutely incredible for his and the age. That, yeah. Jesus Christ, that dude's amazing at trumpet. But, like, because of that, I came, you know, the first one time I came in, I didn't know he worked here. I came in, I saw him, I was like, oh.
No, you work here.
Oh, cool. You work here. Cool. Yeah, let's talk about the Mets.
Yeah.
You know, but because of that, because I know, like, how incredible he is at trumpet, I'm more, like, personally, I'm like, okay, I trust him to hammer on a bell.
Yeah.
Because I know he takes the things that
pride
he does.
Pride in his music.
He takes pride in his music. And he takes pride in the things that he does. Yeah. And he understands, like, if I come in and see a guy who, you know. I'm like, well, you're not, you seem to not care much about this part of your life. I don't know if I want you to be like tinkering with one of my valves.
Yeah.
You know?
And I want the people who work here also to be good musicians because, you know, the level of client and customer that comes in are professional musicians. So if I'm working on something or tweaking a horn for somebody or making a part or, you know, working on something, I can play. I'm a decent enough musician, but I'm not a trumpet player. I'm not a trombone player. So I could give like a trumpet to Matt and say, Matt, play this and tell me what you think. Like, give me your honest opinion. Oh, well, you know, it's a little tight, or, oh man, this horn is great. Oh, though that's valuable input to me also. Or Jesus, like, play this trombone and tell me what you think, you know. though that input is invaluable because, you know, that's like me handing it to the customer and saying, here you go.
and they can even outsource some of that. Yeah. I've been in rehearsals with Jesus on a number of occasions where he had a bag full of mouthpieces.
Hey, man, can I try that mouthpiece?
A bunch of trombonists in the room. And he's just like handing out mouthpieces like,
hey, go try this.
What do you think? What do you think? Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's what I thought too, but you know, how's it feel? Yeah, that kind of thing.
Opinion, especially.
But because he's out playing with people, he can, you know, he can do that. And then he can come back and be like, so this, and this. You know, it's really cool setup.
It is. I'm pretty happy with, I'm thrilled with my staff. And I'm pretty happy with how things go here. You know, and we like to have fun, you know, throughout the days. We joke around and, you know, check out this funny video on Facebook. All right, everybody, take a break and come over here and watch. And
what's the game that you all get that you all play?
Oh, we play like Clash Clans. Clash Royale is the new game. We all sit around in our phones and like, hey man, did you unlock the archers? So it's kind of cool. Ridiculous. And then we, you know, we do like funny texts, like group texts, and you know, it's good. It's good and also it's difficult for me because all my employees I consider friends. So when I have to like crack down and be a boss, you know, it's really tough. So like recently, you know, I now, because I'm not a businessman, I didn't go to business school, I didn't work in a human resources department or anything like that. So now as I'm, you know, as the business is growing and I'm trying to grow the business, because I'm, you know, I'm happy with where things are, but I have a goal. I have like a vision in my head where I want the business to be. You know, there was an issue with like people and scheduling, and you know, it'd be like the day of, oh, I forgot to tell you, I have to leave early because I got a rehearsal. Well, you know, that's kind of screws everybody. Yeah. Or, oh man, I was really out late gigging last night and I got a headache, I can't come in. You know, I understand those types of things, but it recently sparked me having to write like a policy sheet about coming to work on time or drinking at events at the shop and things like that to where, you know, I got to be the boss.
Yeah.
Well, I hate being the boss.
And that's one of the, you know, and that's funny because that's one of the really cool parts about your shop is that you do have these events, you know, different manufacturers or Like the
yeah, I've got two French horn ones coming up in June, back to back days, a Friday and a Saturday.
And so there's
two different horn menus.
There's barbecue, there's food, yeah, man. There's beer, there's wine, you know, like, and that's in the middle of the day. Yes, yeah. Yes, brass players day drink, it's a yeah. thing.
And that's me also wanting to, I want, you know, as part of the business and the shop, so I want this for a place to, for people to come and hang out. And the first time I did my like grand opening party, a few years back, people showed up and there were people who hadn't seen each other in, you know, like 20 years. Mm-hmm. And I was like, oh man, you and I, we played Maynard's band, or, you know, we did that tour, and oh, we played this show together. And people were reuniting and kindling old relationships. And I'm like, man, that's really awesome that this is now, can be a place that people can come together. So when I do these events, like my anniversary parties, I mean, I come out of pocket, you know, like $2,000 or more for food and beverages for people, and then we sure. shut down the work. But to me, that's, I don't mind doing that, because it's like, man, people are coming in, they're enjoying, they're hanging out until 1-2 o'clock in the morning, you know, everybody's, you know, having a good time and socializing, and musicians get to meet other musicians that they wouldn't normally. And I think that's like really, really super cool that there's a place, and that place is mine, that people can do that.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm going to continue to do them. And well, it's also an excuse for me not to work. And it's like, yeah, we're not working on any horns today. We're going to have a party.
That's such a brass player mentality.
Totally. Well, I am a brass player, and I deal with brass players all day long.
Practical question. Do you have to, like, you know, when you have those parties, I mean, people are eating and drinking, but they're also playing horns.
Yeah.
So do you have to clean them out afterwards?
Yeah, we go through, we don't catch everything all the time, but, you know, there's people who come in and they'll play stuff, and, you know, different people's, like, body acidity is different. So, you know, like, just the other day, I have a brand new Schilke Piccolo trumpet that a lot of people have been trying.
Mm-hmm.
And somebody picked it up and he's like, man, this fourth valve feels like shit. And you look in the horn and it's like dirty. Because people come back here and they play it for like 45 minutes and then, oh, okay, thanks, you know. And then somebody else comes in the next day and then they pull oil out of their case and they mix oils and, you know, stuff. So we go through and try to, as much as possible, do that. And I've even told people they can't play instruments here before. Because, like, you know, I've had people come in who stink.
Mm-hmm.
Or who have bad oral hygiene and really bad breath. And when they play a horn, that goes into the horn. Yeah. You pick it up, it's like, woo, doggy.
Yeah.
So, you know, that happens.
Mm-hmm.
So we need to go through and we need to clean things and oil. And after parties, you know, I try to go through with as much stuff as we can.
But on the flip side, like, the I'm fostering the environment for this kind of, like, you know, overall, at least in my experience, New York brass players,
it's a family, it's a community.
It's a fun family to be a part of as a professional brass player
and
in the city.
And I'm thrilled as can be that people come in here. And I mean, people I look up to musically, like, you know, like earlier today, Stephen Bernstein and James Zoller were in.
Mm-hmm.
Two amazing trumpet players. And they were talking about, like, being on the road together 30 years ago. And these are two people that, you know, it's like, you guys are amazing musicians. And you're coming in here and you're hanging out and you're talking. And you're coming to me for advice. It's like, holy shit. Like, or like when, you know, like an orchestra cat comes in. And they're oh, you know, can you do this for my horn? And, you know, I'm having trouble with this. You know, I look at, you know, still in the back of my mind as, like, you know, a top orchestral musician, as somebody who makes no mistakes.
Right.
Because, you know, you go to an orchestra concert, you're like a personal trumpet player, like, dun, 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 and they kill the note, everybody knows. So they're precise, they're on. So when they come in here and they're like, you know, can you do this, or I need a new mouthpiece, or I'm like, oh, holy shit. Like,
yeah.
They're coming here. And to me, that's like the most rewarding thing is, like I said before, helping musicians do their job to the best of their ability. And that that really is what kind of drives me.
Yeah.
That nobody else is doing it.
Yeah.
You know, that's like, I want to make it bigger and better because nobody else is doing it and all the other businesses have closed because it's so hard to do and I want a challenge.
Yeah.
And I'll take, yeah, you know, I'm like, right now the business is like, I got like $100,000+ in credit card and outstanding loans on the business to try to drum it up to do like the expansion. Like I took a $75,000 loan from the bank to expand the business. And then I racked up like another $50,000 in credit card to do the expansion. And it's like, you know, I could be perfectly content sitting in a room, you know, working on one or two instruments, three instruments a day by myself, and that's that. But I want bigger. I want, like, I want this place to be like the shit, like these practice rooms, like the rooms we're in now. This is dead space. Like, you know, I have this room and I book these rooms out $10 an hour. That's dirt cheap. But people don't come in and they don't book the space. So now it's like, well, you know, I could turn this room in with a $20,000 investment. I could do my own silver and gold plating in-house, like professional style. And, you know, 20 grand is a big investment, but it's not a huge investment on the larger scope of things. But at the same time, it's like, I want a room that people can play in. So then there's that dilemma of, you know, how do I grow the things? Or, you know, I buy instruments to have in sale for people where it's like, man, I could buy, you know, this, you know, new CNC lathe or this milling machine or these tools, or instead of, you know, oh, let me buy this trumpet so I can eventually sell it, or buy this trombone so I can eventually sell it, or let me buy this mouthpiece because it was a famous person's mouthpiece to have in a display and never sell it.
Yeah, I mean, you have the case out there.
With the museum case.
Yeah. I mean, are those instruments for sale?
No.
Oh, okay.
I mean,
if someone made the right offer.
I'm in business. So technically, yes, everything is for sale. There's only a few things that I would never sell. Well, I say never, but like I've turned down offers on certain things that I have for in the store.
Right. So what remind me what's in the case? I've looked at it 100 times.
Let's see. I've got Clark Terry's trumpet and flugelhorn and his mouthpieces and his mutes and his master set lists. I've got Henry Bussey's trumpets, who Henry Bussey was Paul Whiteman's first trumpet player, and then later ran Al Capone's Jazz Club in Chicago. I have Art Farmer's flugelhorn. I have one of Wallace Roney's trumpets. I have mouthpieces for, I have Dizzy Gillespie's mouthpiece that he used from 1946 to 1957. I have one of Louis Armstrong's mouthpieces. I have two of Miles Davis's mouthpieces. I have Pete Candoli's mouthpiece. I have Edward Llewellyn, who is principal trumpet in the Chicago Symphony in the 20s, his mouthpiece. I have one of the oldest known Bach mouthpieces. I've got one of Buck Clayton's mouthpieces. You know, like...
So, yeah.
But I've got stuff. So. I've got on display Don Fagerquist's Martin Committee. You know, I have these things that, to me, you know, I don't want to sell it because it's history. You know, and it's important to me to preserve history. And that's where my collector side comes into things. It's like, man, I've got hundreds of horns that I've bought over the years that I need to restore just for the historical importance of them. And I've spent tens and tens of thousands of dollars on these just to have to preserve the history. And to me, that's like a very important thing. You know, because, you know, years from now, what do we have of a record of things? It's just the history that people remember and the objects and the stories. And to me, that's a very, very important thing to preserve. So that's why I don't sell the stuff. So like yesterday, Miles Davis's eldest son, Gregory Davis, came in.
Oh, did he?
Oh, yeah. Gregory is a... I like Gregory. I've known him for many years. I've made a couple instruments for him. Nice man, interesting guy. And I'm like, I show him one of Miles's mouthpieces. Like, yeah, that's my dad's mouthpiece. How much do you want to sell it to me for? I'm like, well, Gregory, you know, it's not really for sale. He's like, I'll give you $200 for it. I'm like, Gregory.
No.
Like, a new Monette mouthpiece is $200. Like, $200 for me. He's like, well, it was my father's mouthpiece. You should sell it to me. I'll give you $300. I'm like, Gregory, like, that's not even like close to a realistic number for, you know, an authentic Miles Davis mouthpiece of what, you know, it's so far. Well, how much do you want to sell it for? I'm like, I don't want to sell it. It's not for sale. So then he like points to the Clark Terry stuff and he's like, well, how much for the gig bag? I'm like, that stuff's not for sale, Gregory. Well, you know, Clark was my godfather. You know, how much you want to sell the case for? I'm like, I don't want to sell it. Like, that is history. That was Clark's instruments that he lost 32, 33 years ago. It's important that they stay here and that they're here for people to use or look at. And if you know, somebody like Wynton Marsalis or somebody was doing like a Clark Terry tribute thing, hey, would you like to use Clark's instruments on this?
Yeah.
Or, you know, somebody comes in and they're like a Miles Davis fan or something. Would you like to play Miles Davis's mouthpiece, one of his mouthpieces? Because I will let you.
And then you can watch their heads explode.
Yeah. They're like, wow, that's a really shitty mouthpiece. You know, that stuff is cool to me, and it's important to have that
mm-hmm.
history. And, you know, those are kind of the aspects of the business that...
that aren't necessarily quantifiable in dollars and right. cents coming in.
Right, right. Or generating income from. It's like, I'm going to spend, a couple $1,000 on this, and it's going to sit in a display case, and I'm never going to sell it. Until I'm, like, old or, my kid's in college and I'm broke or I want to retire. And it's like, let's put this in an auction house.
College is not getting less expensive.
Well, that's why he's going to learn German so he can go to college in Germany for free.
Or German, Danish.
Well, Germany offers Swedish. Free college to Americans.
Oh, well, what? Jesus, why didn't I know about that? Anyway, well, I probably wouldn't have learned German.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's that.
Nine.
So, I mean, obviously you've only been in this, you know, you're up on the fifth floor of this building on 36th Street for a few years.
Yeah, 2.5 years.
And then now, like...
And now we've been in here a year now.
You're right.
Fifth floor.
Yeah.
In September, it'll be 4 years that I've been open.
Right. Okay. Yeah.
God, it feels like it's been like a decade from the hours that I put in, but I love
maybe.
It.
Maybe. What?
I love it.
Yeah. You know, maybe on the last anniversary party, I bought my small horn. Maybe the next one, I'll buy another horn for funsies.
do an anniversary party deal.
We'll see how the summer goes. see what I can pull in over the summer. most of that.
But even if people don't buy stuff, you know, it doesn't bother me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, of course, you know, having a lot of inventory and a lot of money tied up in things, I would like to see things sell. But I would rather somebody not buy something that's not right for them and wait for something that is,
mm-hmm.
and then maybe in the hopes that I have the right instrument for them.
Yeah, and if you get that perfect match, like it's at some point it becomes, I mean, it is about the money, but at a certain point when you have these personal relationships with people, it's about more than just the money.
Like I've told numerous people in many times, yeah, you shouldn't buy that instrument, or don't buy that mouthpiece, or, you know, somebody comes in and they want their horn cleaned, and it's like, I look inside, I'm like, well, your horn's not dirty, go home and give it a soap and water bath. Here's a $5 cleaning snake and go and buy a bottle of Dawn soap. You know,
are you sure it's the horn? Are you sure you're just not practicing?
Yeah, you know, I try not to say that so much.
Well, I can.
But
I try to
do what's best for the customer and not what's best for my pocket. Even though, you know, it's like, it's expensive to run this business. Before I pay an employee, before I bring in a single product, it's $10,000 a month for utilities, rent, and insurance. So, you know, of course I need to be a businessman and make a profit and, you know, pay my employees so they can eat hot food. I don't care if they pay rent. But,
no, because then they'll be sleeping in this practice room.
Hey, man, I have slept on this floor once. My wife accidentally locked me out of the apartment not too long ago with the deadbolt and like the hotel latch that goes over and you can only open the door a little bit. And she was dead asleep and her ringer was off. And I called her cell phone like 100 times and banged on the fucking door and nothing.
Well,
so I came. I'm like, well, I'm gonna take the train back from Queens, and I'm gonna go and sleep on the floor in the shop.
that's amazing. So I mean, what you know, I mean, we've talked a little bit about the, you know, wanting to make this bigger and better, mm-hmm. because you're the only one who's kind of doing what, you know, doing what you do. Mm-hmm. Like, do you have like concrete ideas as far as like, you know, obviously there's you know, you have ideas of where you want things to go.
Yeah, yeah, I have things that I'm working on and in plans in the work, but it's a lot of it all comes down to money. To be honest, you know, like if I want to have all the products that people want or need at any time possible, but that's hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of thousands of dollars that I don't have yet to do. And I still don't pay myself a salary. I haven't, short of like, you know, some money here and there when I need to pay rent, I have not paid myself since opening the shop. Which sucks. But the long-term goal is to have a place for musicians that they can get and do whatever they need to do their jobs. Instruments, accessories, repairs, plating, rehearsal rooms, lessons. I want that all under one roof. Like, I want like a brass mecca for people. Like, oh, you never played a cimbasso? Well, here's four cimbassos to choose from. Or, you know, that's a little extreme.
One is probably more than
enough. Yeah. But that's kind of like the long-term goal, is to have something that, you know, people can come and rely on and get the products they need and the service they need all in the same place. And I think it's important in a city, especially New York, that has such a rich musical history as far as musicians and craftsmen, that still be alive. I mean, used to have tons of manufacturers making instruments in New York over the last 150 years that are no longer in existence. You used to have, like we talked about, music, 48th Street with all the music stores in all that stuff is gone. And I think it's very, 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 very important to keep that going. And that's why I, you know, like, burn my hands and don't sleep and don't eat is all for to keep that alive. And that's basically it.
Yeah, no, that's awesome. And
I do what I can. And hopefully my wife will still love me for being an absent husband, and my child doesn't despise me when he's old enough to despise me.
Don't bring it down. We had a really nice
and that you can edit that part out. No, man, it's all worthwhile. Yeah. And it'll all pay off in the long run. I'm a pretty happy guy.
Yeah. Well, Josh, thank you so much.
Dan, thank you for your time. Fun. It's an honor to be a part of your podcast. People need to listen and tune in, and if not, no, I'm not going to fix your instrument.
Well, there you go. That's that.